Blog Talk Radio. Greetings. This is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Thursday, June 6, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Coming up later, we'll bring you our regular Pan-African Newswire report with some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. And in the second and third hours, we'll listen to the Electronic Intifada, one of the primary sources on the current situation in occupied Palestine. And, of course, these and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. And we'd like to take our musical interlude with the legendary Franco. Let's listen in.
Thank you. Baliga na yo Tosani makati ye boti de la rose Na yo kile lo lingi yo boya gaye Foko makae kote kana moliri La rose watio Foka ni satero Na ye biyo so juwinde batekyo Ye bi sangaye na boyinde kotongo Na ye biyo so na kone la tiyo Na yo kale lo lobi na pingiyo Epa ya nanyo Ebanda ki balingo yo te wateo Ebala na kingay na yo ba famiye teo Lelo na komi mo balinde ya poison Na peti pante na kompo ya shalangaye O profite o lelo na sambo y barso O botani di ya kuru zenga na bema Na komi ya pole se po na bolingo Oyote ite yo mo na gai longo ba Mwana ya bolumbo e Tata ya roki e
Oh, pedaleo, oh, pedaleo, na pedaleo na zongi
na ko wande boye di bomboko
bomboko tata mwana zongi
basala yonso di bomboko
bomboko tata mwana zongi.
Afuala aningelego kala kokingangwe nga munufuala ani bani ulubanza muni kala ingangwe abaleko lusethi nkunga
kala ingangwe kala ingangwe mbongo siya fala kala ingangwe kala ingangwe mbongo siya fala
kala ingangwe kala ingangwe nane ukumbute
kala ingangwe kala ingangwe mbongo siya fonye kala ingangwe kala ingangwe mbongo siya fonye
fala kala ingangwe kala ingangwe mbongo siya fonye
kala ingangwe kala ingangwe mbongo siya fala
kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fonye. Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, nane
ukumbute. Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fonye. Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fonye.
Kala kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fonye.
Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fonye. Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fonye.
Kala ingangwe,
kala ingangwe, mbongo siya
fala. Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, nane ukumbute.
Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fonye. Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya
fonye. Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fonye.
Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fala. Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fala. Kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fonye. Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fonye. Kala ingangwe, kala ingangwe, mbongo siya fonye.
Ngai mwana yo na sepe ya lelo, ngai mwana yo na seke na lelo, bona zongi lelo na lipopo. Ngai mwana yo na sepe ya lelo, ngai mwana yo na seke na lelo, bona zongi lelo na etanda. Ngai mwana yo na sepe ya lelo, ngai mwana yo na seke na lelo, bona zongi lelo na lipopo. Ngai mwana yo na sepe ya lelo. Ngai mwana yo na seka na lelo, bona zongi lelo na etanda. Ngai mwana yo na sepe na lelo, ngai mwana yo na seka na lelo. Bona zongi lelo na lipopo. Ngai mwana yo na sepe na lelo. Ngai mwana yo na seke na lelo. Bona zongi lelo na etanda. Na sepe na lelo, na sepe na lelo. Bona zongi lelo na lipopo. Na sepe na lelo, na sepe na lelo. Bona zongi lelo na lipopo. Na sepe na lelo, na sepe na lelo. Bona zongi lelo na lipopo. Na sepe na lelo. Na sepe na lelo, bona zongi lelo na lipopo. Thank you.
lelo, nasepela lelo, pona zongiye lelo na lipopo. Nasepela lelo, nasepela lelo, pona zongiye lelo na lipopo. Nasepela lelo, nasepela lelo, pona zongiye lelo na lipopo. Nasepela lelo, nasepela lelo, pona zongiye lelo na lipopo.
Thank you. ki na lini na zonga mboka makambo maliki na lini na bibo mabwema doki na zuaki mobali oya kolinga kani awa na zuite na lini ne na kende nanga nani ya kote kaka bolingo pona zomba atambo ngweleki ebongi se mobali Zalibongi na langye, mwasi ya bonga na mobali. Chiza zalibongi na langye, mwasi ya bonga na mobali.
Na moni ya, na tuni ya, adrasa ya pamba okata linga linga lao.
Chiza zalibongi na langye, mwasi ya bonga na mobali. Chiza zalibongi na langye, mwasi ya bonga na mobali.
Kanisa Zuwa yoko salaka mwasi Oko tindaka ye Alingangai mingi Oko tobo kalibumu Kona zuwa Mwasi na yo Lombi ako kima yo Oyembi Bongo yoko pesa kaye, ako pesa kangai, na somba ka essence. Tala likambo, tamone neboye. Mwasi na yo, azuiki zungu zungu. Ngai moi na butu Pona mwasi na yo Na salinini Banda na banda Bako kutanaka Yangai na yo Eko mindeni kamboe Kokakate kosala baninga mabe bona mesana ndenge wana teo oyoki oyoki mbanda nangayo lobi yaka nakozongisela yo mwasi na yo pobo fandai na boy nangai Basi ya baningao, eko pesa kabato, ba malchance. Oyoki, oyoki, mbanda nangayo. na yebi solo na sala ki mabe e sala ki fonte yanga iteo na kotu bela lobi yanga de masumu pombalimbi sanga di kambonde ni sila oyoki oyoki banda nanga yo.
Fala o jambo mbo katengila kunche ngamono ndeilanda 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 fala o jambo mbo katengila kunche ngamono ndeilanda
Oh, Jacob Bombera is
music of the legendary Franco, the TPOK Jazz Orchestra. That was a collection of recordings from 1960 to 1964, and June is Black Music Month, and all during this month, and in fact, all during the times that the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio broadcast is on the air, we focus heavily on the classic sounds of African music, and of course, we'll have more music from Franco in the weeks to come during this month of June. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for this Thursday, June the 6th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. And these are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. The spokesperson for the Russian Foreign Ministry tells Al-Mahdeen that Russia has opportunities and future prospects for cooperation with African countries. Russia considers cooperation with Africa to be an equal partnership, which is very important. The spokesperson for the Russian Foreign Ministry, Maria Zakharova, pointed out on Thursday, the African continent has been subjected to intimidation and mistreatment over the past centuries by the countries that colonized, enslaved, and plundered it. Zakharova indicated in an exclusive statement for Al-Mahdeen during the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. She stressed that one of the greatest achievements of the Soviet Union was playing the most significant role in ending colonization, adding that she believes contributing to the end of colonization made the world a better place. Zakharova noted that whenever Russian officials visited African countries, they received words of thanks and appreciation for what the Soviet Union did back then and what Russia is doing now, regardless of the political paths undertaken by the African governments in those countries. The spokesperson affirmed that Russia has opportunities and future prospects for cooperation with African countries based on the notion of equality and not on colonialism. In other news related to the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the Israeli occupation committed a massacre after midnight on Thursday, targeting Palestinians at the United Nations Refugee Works Agency, which provides assistance to the Palestinians. A cable news network investigation of footage from the area and a study by an explosive weapons expert revealed that U.S.-made explosives were used in a fatal Israeli attack on a United Nations-run school in central Gaza that happened earlier today, where Palestinians were taking refuge. Al-Mahdeen's correspondent in the Gaza Strip, citing medical sources, reported that at least 40 Palestinians were killed and dozens were injured after the Israeli occupation deliberately hit an UNRWA school sheltering displaced individuals in Camp 2 area of Nusayr in central Gaza Strip with an airstrike. The correspondent stated that the occupation warplanes committed this massacre after midnight, adding that the Al-Sa'di school, which was bombed, shelters displaced Palestinians. The Gaza government media office issued a statement following the bombing of the school, noting that the death toll is expected to rise due to the large numbers of severely injured Palestinians. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In other news, the Hamas movement has clarified its position, maintaining its stance on Biden's earlier statements, while highlighting the contradictory nature of the U.S. president's subsequent remarks. The Hamas movement sent an explanatory memorandum addressing indirect negotiations with the Israeli occupation government. This followed a statement by U.S. President Joe Biden on Friday, May the 31st, announcing the Israeli proposal regarding a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The explanatory memorandum from the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, says in light of President Biden's declarations about the need to end the war, withdraw occupation forces, allow aid entry, return the displaced and rebuild, and considering the statements from officials in the occupation government and the U.S. administration, as well as what we have heard from mediators in Qatar and Egypt regarding a proposal from the occupation government referenced by President Biden, it has become clear to us that the enemy's position lacks clarity. There are contradictions in the statements of the senior officials, and the Biden administration is shaping the movement's approval as the primary obstacle in framing the issue. The U.S. administration's media, political, and diplomatic efforts highlighted this, creating a picture that lacks clarity. You can read this article in its entirety, this explanatory memorandum sent by the Hamas organization. And, of course, all you need to do is log on to the Pan-African Newswire. And in Lebanon, Hezbollah says that Shell, the headquarters of the Israeli occupation military's 91st Division, and the Birnit barracks with the Falak 1 rockets, the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah announced Thursday a series of new operations against the Israeli occupation military sites and troops. In a statement, Hezbollah confirmed that its resistance fighter Shell, the headquarters of the Israeli occupation military's 91st Division in the Birnit barracks and the positions of soldiers in its vicinity with Falak 1 rockets, resulting in its partial destruction and confirmed casualties. The resistance said the operation came in support of the steadfast Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip and their brave and honorable resistance, and in response to the Israeli attacks on the steadfast southern villages and safe homes, most recently in the town of Atarun. And we'll have a more detailed analysis and information on the situation in Gaza in our next segment. That's going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. In concluding this segment of our program, we want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast, all you need to do is go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
I'm sorry, baby. I'm sorry. feel. Will you be there? Will you be there, baby, when I step down from the train? Will you be there, baby? You just got to be there, baby, when somebody calls my name. Yeah, I'm lonely, baby.
Another luminary in the legacy of black music in the United States and indeed the world, the none other than Al Green out of Arkansas and Memphis, Tennessee. The track entitled Are You Lonely For Me, Baby, a classic rhythm and blues track originally from the 1960s. Of course, that song was from 1971, 1972. At any rate, great music. Right now, we want to move into our Palestine update. And, of course, the genocide is continuing in Palestine, financed by the tax dollars of working class and oppressed people in the United States. And, of course, the president has refused to rein in the Israeli Defense Forces, which are laying waste to Gaza. Let's listen to the latest edition of Electronic Intifada.
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, June 5th. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. Asa Wynn-Stanley is off this week. It's day 243 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Coming up in this broadcast, we'll have a discussion on the prospects for the ceasefire proposal and other regional and global developments with Helena Cobbin. And of course, John Elmer will cover all the latest news from the resistance across Gaza, including the combat footage from the final days of the battle in the Jabalia refugee camp. And I wanted to let our viewers know that Tamara has recorded a tutorial for turning on live captioning during this live stream. You can find a link to that in the description below. But first, some of the news from Gaza and the West Bank between May 30th and June 5th. Israeli occupation forces pounded areas across the Gaza Strip this past week, from Gaza City in the north to Rafah in the south. On Monday, Tuesday, and into today, Israel bombed central Gaza's Burej and Maghazi refugee camps as Israeli troops began a ground invasion into the eastern part of the area. Al Jazeera reporter Hani Mahmoud stated on Tuesday that, quote, entire families in Burej refugee camp are caught in the line of fire right now. They cannot leave the targeted areas due to the presence of attack jets, quadcopters, and the constant artillery shelling. Ambulances and paramedics are unable to get to these areas. He added that these attacks further increase, quote, the difficulties of the situation for people who have already moved from Rafah and the western part of Rafah seeking shelter in the central area. Journalist Maha Husseini reported on Tuesday that residents were evacuating Burej refugee camp as the Israeli attacks escalated. Israel had bombed Burej camp days earlier as well on Sunday, killing six, including children. The bombing continued overnight. Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, stated earlier today that, quote, at least 70 dead people and over 300 wounded, the majority of whom are women and children, have been brought to Al-Aqsa Hospital since yesterday following heavy Israeli strikes in the middle area of the Gaza Strip. The group's medical advisor, Karen Huster, said, quote, "The odor of blood in the hospital's emergency room this morning was unbearable. There are people lying everywhere on the floor outside. Bodies were being brought in plastic bags. The situation is overwhelming." She added, quote, "Medical teams in Al-Aqsa Hospital, one of the only remaining functional health facilities in the middle area, are currently trying to deal with a huge influx of patients, many of them arriving with severe burns, shrapnel wounds, fractures, and other traumatic injuries. With the insane escalation of violence in various locations in the Gaza Strip over the last 48 hours, and while the Rafah crossing point has remained closed for a month, the health system has been stretched to the point of collapse. The situation is apocalyptic." Also in central Gaza, Israeli airstrikes and tanks attacked areas in and around Nuseirat refugee camp on Sunday and again on Tuesday. Israel attacked Deir el-Balah in a series of strikes on Tuesday, killing at least 20 Palestinians, including 8 policemen who were killed when Israeli occupation forces bombed their car. The Gaza's Interior Ministry office stated Tuesday that the airstrike on the police officers occurred in front of a displaced person's shelter, where the police were reportedly working. The ministry stated that, quote, "the occupation's perpetuation of the crime by continuing to target members of the police force with the aim of spreading chaos will fail, and the police force will continue to carry out its duty in serving the citizens, no matter the sacrifices." Philippe Lazzarini, the head of the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, stated over the weekend that over the last month, more than 1 million people, most of whom have been displaced several times, were forced to flee once again in search of safety that they can never find. The United Nations said that to date, about 78% of the Gaza Strip has been placed under evacuation orders by the Israeli military. The charity Oxfam stated on Tuesday that, quote, "Israel's relentless air and land bombardment and deliberate obstruction of humanitarian response is making it virtually impossible for aid agencies to reach trapped, starved civilians in Gaza as the latest ceasefire deal negotiations continue. A lethal combination of closed border crossings, ongoing airstrikes, reduced logistical capacity due to evacuation notices, and a failing Israeli permission process that debilitates humanitarian movement within Gaza have created an impossible environment for aid agencies to operate effectively." The charity added that over 1 million people have fled Rafah into Al-Mawasi, Deir el-Balah, and Khan Yunus. 1.7 million people, more than two-thirds of Gaza's population, are now estimated to be crammed into an area of 69 square kilometers, less than a fifth of the total area of Gaza. Despite Israeli assurances that full support would be provided for people fleeing, most of Gaza has been deprived of humanitarian aid as famine inches closer. Last week, Israeli attacks killed dozens of civilians in tents in areas it had declared safe zones. Helmi Hirez, a 19-year-old computer science student from the El Rimal neighborhood in Gaza City, told Al Jazeera that he and his family fled the city during Israel's attacks on Al-Shifa Hospital in March. He walked all the way from Gaza City to Rafah, about 32 kilometers. A few days after he left, 14 members of his family who stayed in Gaza City were killed in an Israeli airstrike. He was sheltering for 3 months in Rafah until another airstrike leveled a building next to him, burying him, his siblings, and parents under the rubble. He survived, but his mother was killed. He then fled to Al-Mawasi and has been sheltering in a tent in the sand dunes there. He spoke to Al Jazeera on Monday from Deir el-Balah. Here's a clip from an interview with Helmi.
We're now in Al-Mawasi area in Khan Yunis city. We're less than 2 kilometers far from where the Israeli army exists in Rafah. In Mawasi area, we are super worried that the Israeli army may come again to Khan Yunis, invading the Al-Mawasi area, making a new refugees wave towards Deir el-Balah or another area in the south of Gaza Strip. The people are super worried. You can walk in the markets in Al-Mawasi area. You always see the people looking at the south, looking at the fire that is coming from Rafah City. you can see the nervous in all the faces here in Almawasi. I'm a computer engineer student, and my brother is an AI engineer student. We knew nothing but coding, and that's how our lives was before the war. All day long, just coding, all days long. This is the hardest task in our life. Now, in Almawasi, our life is just standing alive, secure 1 gallon of water, or just guarding the tent, cooking on fire. This is the picture I was talking last year when we, on our last day in high school. At the left, it is me, Hilmi. My name in Arabic means my dream. In the middle, my mother, Ibtisam, which in Arabic means smile, and she always smiles. And at the right, my identical twin brother, Muhammad.
What do you dream of today, Hilmi?
A safe place. A safe place. And just another opportunity to get my family back together and to get my family back on foot and in a safe place. We lost our house. We lost our relatives. We lost the most precious thing in life, which is my mom. I just want my family to get back together on one table in a safe place, that I'm not worried tonight, that I can sleep safely and don't think about that a rocket may hit us. I mean, the bombing that killed my mother in Rafah, it was at 2:10 a.m. after midnight. We all were asleep.
That was Hilmi Hirez, a 19-year-old computer science student, speaking to Al Jazeera on Monday. In northern Gaza, Palestinians returned to their neighborhoods following the Israeli army's withdrawal in Jabalia and Gaza City. Journalists captured video of the Israeli army shelling people as they attempted to inspect their homes near the destroyed University College of Applied Sciences, where bodies were discovered to have been crushed by tanks. The Gaza municipality organized a public campaign to clear the streets of Gaza City following the Israeli army's withdrawal. Dozens of Palestinians working with their neighborhood committees worked to remove the mountains of rubble and debris. Last week, the Israeli army withdrew from Jabalia after a 20-day operation that left the area and its refugee camp, the largest of the Gaza Strip's 8 camps, almost unrecognizable. Our colleague Tamara Nassar reported that the Israeli army had ordered residents of Jabalia to evacuate the area earlier in May, following a previous invasion that ended in December, and that this latest ground invasion was combined with aerial bombardment. Israel conducted 200 airstrikes in the area during a period of less than 3 weeks. Photos and videos circulated on social media as Palestinians started to return to their neighborhoods in and around Jabalia and the Jabalia refugee camp on Thursday. However, people were still shot at by Israeli quadcopter drones on their way to return to their homes. On Thursday, Al Jazeera's Mohammed Shaheen reported from Jabalia and explained the vast scale of the destruction.
We are now at the trans intersection in Jabalia camp in the north of the Gaza Strip, where the Israeli occupation forces have destroyed expansive parts of the camp. Most property and civilians' belongings have been destroyed in the Israeli military operation that lasted nearly 20 days. The Israeli occupation forces withdrew from the camp on Thursday morning, leaving in their wake this vast destruction. Fires resulting from Israeli shelling continue to burn. The Israeli forces continue to fire weapons in the street which leads to Zayed and Beit Hanun neighborhoods, so the situation is still dangerous. Some residents tried to go down this road towards the northern parts of the Jabalia camp, but came under fire. We can see here that a firebelt bombing targeted this street, causing vast destruction. We can still hear the sound of artillery shells at the other end of this street.
Look at the scale of destruction in Jabalia. The Israelis have destroyed us. They're actually testing their missiles on us.
Residents here say that this scale of destruction is as a result of Israeli use of weapons provided by the United States. They say that the Gaza Strip, including Jabalia camp, has been used by Israel as a testing ground for weapons.
That was Al Jazeera's Mohammed Shaheen reporting from Jabalia last week. Satellite imagery showed the amount of Israel's destruction of Jabalia between mid-April and the end of May. On Sunday, Gaza's Civil Defense Corps said that they had been working 3 days in a row to recover bodies buried under the rubble. Tamara reports that, quote, now amid the rubble of their destroyed homes, Palestinians are returning to the camp from which they evacuated a few weeks ago. They are erecting makeshift tents amid the debris and demonstrating resilience by caring for stray cats, illustrating their determination to revive their community, the devastation. She adds, quote, Jabalia's resilience haunts the Israeli army. The resilience can be seen in the strong culture of armed struggle in the camp. And we'll have much more on the armed struggle by Palestinian fighters in Jabalia with John Elmer later on in this broadcast. For much more on Jabalia, read Tamara Nassar's latest report, Invasions Fail to Break the Spirit of Resistance in Jabalia, as well as Everything I Loved has Gone by Osama Abu Jasser on electronicintifada.net. A new report released by the Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor says that Israel is ramping up its use of armed quadcopter drones to kill, injure, and terrorize Palestinians across Gaza. These drones have killed dozens of civilians, as confirmed by Euromed Monitor in earlier reports, by firing automatic machine guns mounted beneath an aircraft at random gatherings or shooting directly at people, Euromed reports. Israel's army is using the so-called Smash Dragon system made by the Israeli company Smart Shooter, which can be supplied to various aircraft. Also the Matrice 600 and the Thor aircraft made by the company Elbit Systems, all of which are highly mobile and versatile. That is ideal for short-term operations. Their systems can automatically search buildings and create maps to identify possible targets, carry lethal or non-lethal payloads, and carry out a variety of missions for military personnel and special forces, Euromed states. The group adds that, quote, Israel has used quadcopter drones in a systematic and widespread manner lately to carry out extrajudicial executions and premeditated killings of Palestinian civilians, according to testimonies gathered by Euromed Monitor. These drones are used in particular against civilians who attempt to return and inspect their homes after the Israeli military retreats from areas it has attacked by land or air. They say that some drones were made mainly for use in photography and other industries, but were converted by the Israeli army into intelligence aircraft and instead used for extrajudicial killings and executions. Drones with various attributes and functional features, known as quadcopters, are produced by Israeli military companies. With a diameter of no more than 1 meter, they are simple to program and use for remote electronic flying, Euromed reports. The United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees stated this week that all of the agency's 36 shelters in Rafah are empty now, after Palestinians have been forced to flee and all health and critical services have been forced to stop. Martin Griffiths, the United Nations humanitarian chief, said that the UN does not have the capacity to deliver humanitarian assistance to Palestinians in Rafah, in southern Gaza, and in the enclave's central areas. Quote, we know what we need and we know what we haven't got, Griffiths said. We need fuel and it's not being brought in great numbers. We need truckloads of food that get through. According to the United Nations, aid deliveries have dropped by two-thirds since Israel's invasion of Rafah. Oxfam stated that the Rafah crossing, which has been closed for more than a month now since May 7th, there are more than 2,000 aid trucks, the majority of which are carrying food, stuck in a 28-mile traffic jam back to the Egyptian city of Arish. The World Health Organization stated that since May 7th, when Israeli forces seized control of the Rafah crossing, Israel has blocked all medical evacuations from taking place. The WHO estimates that there are as many as 11,000 Palestinians who need urgent medical evacuation out of Gaza. 20 international aid agencies issued a joint warning over the weekend on the further disintegration of access to humanitarian aid. The statement notes that Doctors Without Borders, one of the largest humanitarian and medical providers in Gaza, has been unable to get any supplies into the enclave since May 6th. The lack of clean water supplies puts patients at high risk of disease. Yet desalination kits and submersible pumps to set up sustainable water systems to provide water are almost always denied by the Israeli authorities. The aid agencies, they say, quote, now fear an acceleration in deaths from starvation, disease, and denied medical assistance, while land and sea entry points remain effectively shut to meaningful humanitarian assistance, most desperately fuel, and attacks in areas sheltering civilians intensify. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, stated that children are still dying of hunger in Gaza. One baby reportedly died of starvation and lack of available medical treatment at the Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah on May 30th, and another 13-year-old child died on June 1st. UNICEF's communications chief, Jonathan Crix, stated, quote, if nutrition supplies, especially ready-to-use therapeutic food used to address malnutrition among children, cannot be distributed, the treatment of more than 3,000 children with acute malnutrition will be interrupted. The ongoing situation in Rafah is a disaster for children, he said. He explained that in the agency's experience in similar crises around the world, quote, usually children don't die from malnutrition and dehydration in hospitals. They die at home, in the street, or where they have taken shelter. This means reported deaths of children from malnutrition only show part of the whole toll. There is reasonable concern that in Gaza too, there are significant numbers of children affected by malnutrition who are not represented in reported figures. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces stormed Ramallah and the adjacent town of El Bireh last Thursday, causing a devastating fire in the main vegetable market that destroyed dozens of shops. Middle East Eye reported that Israeli soldiers raided the neighboring West Bank cities at dawn on May 30th, firing live ammunition, stun grenades, and tear gas in residential areas and at the local market known as Al-Hisba. Wooden carts caught on fire and the flames spread throughout the market and to nearby commercial buildings, wounding at least one person and ravaging over 100 stalls and shops, according to El Bireh's acting mayor, Rabin Al-Khatib. Palestinian politician Mustafa Barghouti stated that Israeli forces also stole money from currency exchange offices during the raid. In May, Israeli forces stormed 11 branches of the same money exchange company, stealing more than $1 million in currency. On Monday, Israeli forces killed 3 Palestinians and injured at least 8 others during an invasion into the northern city of Nablus. One of those killed was Adam Faraj, a 23-year-old former prisoner and fighter with the Balata Battalion, who was shot by Israeli troops while he was on his way to his sister's wedding. Video of the killing of Adam Faraj showed the Israeli soldiers desecrating and kicking his body and then dragging it away. On Tuesday, Israeli forces killed 2 Palestinian men by firing at their car in the city of Tulkarem. More than 20 Palestinians were swept up in mass arrest campaigns by Israeli forces on Tuesday, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Society and the Commission of Detained and Ex-Detainees Affairs. The group said that the arrest took place across the occupied West Bank governorates of Ramallah, Bethlehem, Nablus, Salfit, Tubas, Jericho, and Jerusalem. The raids were accompanied by widespread abuse and threats against detainees and their families, the Wafa news agency reported. The total number of Palestinians detained in the occupied West Bank has risen to more than 9,000 since October 7th. This figure includes individuals taken from their homes at military checkpoints, those who surrendered under duress, and those taken hostage by Israeli forces. In the West Bank since October 7th, more than 500 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers and settlers, and nearly 5,000 others have been injured by Israeli army fire, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. And in the South Hebron Hills, Israeli forces demolished a home in Al-Jawaya and assaulted the owner of the house, hitting him with a rifle, according to the Palestinian rights group Al-Haq. At least 250 homes have been destroyed by Israel since the beginning of the year, Al-Haq stated. And finally, we wanted to bring you some images and videos from journalists and others in Gaza who are not just relentlessly documenting the unspeakable atrocities, but also making sure to highlight the resilience, joy, and determination of the Palestinian people. A pharmacist, Omar Hamad, who is sheltering in Deir el-Balah, filmed himself and his father using a manual sewing machine to help displaced people repair their torn clothes. A woman created a short video of herself while she cleaned and cleared debris in her home in Jabalia following the Israeli army's withdrawal. You can hear the Israeli drones hovering above while she works, but she added music to her video as well. Youth in Jabalia, upon returning to their neighborhood, fed stray cats and took a selfie. Our contributor Abu Bakr Abed made a short video report with kids in Deir el-Balah this week, thanking professional soccer players who participated in the Children of Gaza charity match that took place on June 1st in London.
As you can see, we are here in one of the largest displacement camps across the Gaza Strip. Children, traumatized children, deprived of food, water, and everything. They are striving to find some means of life here. We see a charity game for tomorrow held by Anwar El Ghazi and other professional footballers across the globe like Sam Morsi and Adama Traore and many others. We would like to thank you here from Gaza for your immense support and for this charity gift, knowing that the children of Gaza see you and are sending a big, big message of love to you from here, despite the truly unbearable circumstances.
That was Abu Bakr Abed. He also took these photos of displaced people in tents in Deir el-Balah watching the UEFA Champions League game on Sunday, as he said, under Israeli bombings and buzzing drones. Other photos and videos of displaced Palestinians finding a way to watch the match circulated on social media. We like this one of children watching the match and rooting for Real Madrid, which won the championship. And finally, Steve Sosabi, formerly of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, who now runs the Heal Palestine Project, shared this video of a girl, Sara, who is successfully recovering from extreme burns after her home in Gaza was bombed in December, an attack that killed two of her brothers. Steve says that Heal Palestine flew her by medical plane to New York 3 months ago, and now she is, quote, dancing her way out of the hospital thanks to the amazing staff at Northwell and Staten Island Burn Center.
Don't worry about them. They're fighting over who's going to dance. You got to stop.
That was filmed by Steve Sosabi of the Heal Palestine Project. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more. especially to read our new features by our phenomenal writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. Thank you for bringing together so much information from a week that has been so tough for people in Gaza, so tough for people across Palestine, and so tough for those who love and support them around the world.
Yeah. Those videos at the end. I didn't know I was going to get a little choked up. I watched them many, many times putting the report together, but seeing them again is really powerful. Especially, I was just thinking about, we had on Dr. Tarek Lubani last week, and he was talking about the amount of burns that doctors and medical workers are trying to deal with, especially after, the first and second and third tent massacres last week. So to see that girl, Sara, literally dancing her way out of the burn ward in New York was very moving.
And just to see people getting together and cleaning up Gaza City, what it shows you is that Israel has failed to break the society, failed to break the community bonds. Yeah. And that's what this genocide is designed to do. It's not just designed to kill the human beings, it's designed to kill the society.
Right.
And they haven't succeeded.
No. Yeah, that video of people kind of forming community, brigades, community civil defense, and just getting whatever they could, brooms, shovels, their bare hands to clear the rubble in Gaza City.
And at the same time, they're still massacring dozens of people every day.
Yeah.
The starvation continues. People continue, and also just to say how lovely it always is to see our very dear Abu Bakr. And one thing that people will be starting to pick up on is that Abu Bakr is a fanatical football fan
and sports journalist.
I was about to say he's one of the very few, if not the only, world-class Palestinian sports journalists. So we look forward to the day when that's what Abu Bakr can focus on, the thing he loves, instead of just surviving and reporting on all this horror.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, later on, we'll get a full update from John Elmer, who will cover all the latest news from the resistance across Gaza, including the combat footage from the final days of the battle in the Jabalia refugee camp. And coming up, we'll be joined by Helena Cobbin of Just World Educational to talk about the prospects for the ceasefire proposal and other regional and global developments. But before that, Ali, why don't you talk us through what we actually know about the proposal itself, how the U.S. is presenting it, and how the various parties are reacting?
Yeah, it's really utterly bizarre. It's like looking glass world. So let's try to make sense of it before we... bring Helena on, and I'm really looking forward to hear what she thinks. But let's just go back and go through the basics. So on Friday, President Joe Biden made an unexpected speech laying out what he described as a three-phase Israeli ceasefire proposal that would bring about, quote, a durable end to this war. And he laid out three phases. The first phase of 6 weeks would include, quote, a full and complete ceasefire, a withdrawal of Israeli forces from all populated areas of Gaza, release of a number of hostages, including women, the elderly, the wounded, in exchange for the release of hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, end quote. The president also said that Palestinian civilians would return to their homes and neighborhoods all over Gaza, including in the north, and humanitarian assistance would surge with 600 trucks carrying aid into Gaza every single day, end quote. I'll just note there that this administration has been promising that there would be a surge of aid for months. So this is similar to promises they've made before.
And Biden said that during the 6 weeks of phase one, Israel and Hamas would negotiate the necessary arrangements to get to phase two, which is a permanent end to hostilities, end quote. And he says that if those negotiations take longer than 6 weeks, the ceasefire would continue as long as the negotiations continue. The United States, Egypt, and Qatar would work to ensure the negotiations keep going. The United States would hold Israel to the ceasefire and to any agreements, while Egypt and Qatar would guarantee Hamas stuck to them. Then he talks about phase two, which he says would be an exchange for the release of all remaining living hostages, including male soldiers. So he describes male soldiers as hostages when they're POWs, prisoners of war, in fact. But that's the language he uses. He says Israeli forces will withdraw from Gaza, and as long as Hamas lives up to its commitments, a temporary ceasefire would become, in the words of the Israeli proposal, the cessation of hostilities permanently, end of quote. That's Joe Biden speaking. And finally, phase three would be, quote, a major reconstruction plan for Gaza that would commence, and any final remains of hostages who've been killed would be returned to their families, end quote. Now, I can't go through all the speech, but I'm going to mention some key points that really stood out to me. Biden is very vague about the future of Hamas according to his vision. He claims, for example, that this plan, quote, ensures Israel's security, creates a better day after in Gaza without Hamas in power, and sets the stage for political settlement that provides a better future for Israelis and Palestinians alike, end quote. Note there that he says the word without Hamas in power. He doesn't say without Hamas existing at all. So that seems to be an implicit recognition that Hamas will continue to exist. It just won't be in power, according to him. And later in the speech, he says, quote, with the deal, the rebuilding of Gaza will begin. Arab nations and the international community, along with Palestinian and Israeli leaders, to get it done in a manner that does not allow Hamas to rearm, end quote. So again, it appears to be a recognition that Hamas will continue to exist during the reconstruction phase, but if Biden has his way, it just won't be allowed to rearm. I thought those things were notable. But I think what the really key statement was Joe Biden's admission, in effect, that Israel cannot achieve anything by continuing this war, this genocide. And he tries to sugarcoat that by claiming that Israel has already achieved its main goal. So let's just watch a clip of Joe Biden laying that out.
At this point, Hamas no longer is capable of carrying out another October 7th. It's one of the Israelis' main objectives in this war, and quite frankly, a righteous one. I know there are those in Israel who will not agree with this plan and will call for the war to continue indefinitely. Some are even in the government coalition. And they've made it clear they want to occupy Gaza. They want to keep fighting for years. And the hostages are not a priority to them. Well, I've urged the leadership in Israel to stand behind this deal, despite whatever pressure comes. And to the people of Israel, let me say this. As someone who's had a lifelong commitment to Israel, as the only American president who's ever gone to Israel in a time of war, as someone who just sent the U.S. forces to directly defend Israel when it was attacked by Iran, I ask you to take a step back and think of what will happen if this moment is lost. We can't lose this moment. Indefinite war in pursuit of an unidentified notion of total victory will only bog down Israel and Gaza, draining the economic, military, and human resources, and furthering Israel's isolation in the world. That will not bring hostages home. That will not bring an enduring defeat of Hamas. That will not bring Israel lasting security.
I mean, Ali, it sounds like Biden just admitted that Israel's military campaign against Hamas has failed, and that continuing it won't bring the success that has eluded it, you know, so far. Is this the right way to understand what President Biden said?
I think so, and it may just be that President Biden is watching our live streams and listening to John Elmer, because it sounds like, whoever wrote his speech understands that the longer Israel stays in Gaza, the worse it gets for Israel. Of course, it's far worse for people in Gaza, but there's no victory to be had. Now, I want to just point out, and this is important when we try to understand the rest of this, that superficially, the proposal that Biden lays out, which he claims is an Israeli proposal, is very similar to a proposal that Hamas publicly embraced and accepted in early last month, in early May. And you can see the terms of that summarized here on May 6th by Al Jazeera, who produced this this sort of infographic, which summarizes that earlier proposal. And as you can see, it's very similar. There's the first stage of 6 weeks, which has cessation of hostilities, some withdrawal of Israeli forces, Palestinians returning home, humanitarian aid coming in, and so on. Then there's a second stage in which military operations end permanently, Israel withdraws from Gaza completely, more prisoner exchange, and then the third stage, which includes the reconstruction and the end of the siege. So superficially, they look very similar. And that's a point that the State Department, the U.S. government, is making in repeatedly, as we'll see. But a key point is, since Friday, the way the United States has been trying to sell this deal is to insist that Hamas is the rejectionist party, is the obstacle to an agreement, even though the U.S. insists that this supposedly Israeli proposal is nearly identical to the one Hamas accepted exactly a month ago. So let's take a look at State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller speaking. This was on June 3rd, so this was on Monday.
The world should know, the Palestinian people should know, that the only thing standing in the way of an immediate ceasefire today is Hamas. The proposal on the table is nearly identical to what Hamas said it would accept just a few weeks ago, and it is now time for them to act. It is time for them to accept the deal. It is time to finalize this agreement and put an end to the suffering of Israelis and Palestinians alike.
Yeah. So
where do we even start? Yeah.
Right. So as you can see, he's saying that, this is nearly identical to what Hamas already accepted. So, I mean, it doesn't make sense to accuse Hamas of rejecting something that you also say they've already accepted. And that's just part of the incoherence of trying to puzzle through what they're saying. And we'll come back to that. We also see in what the State Department is presenting some of the continued vagueness in terms of what the future of Hamas that we saw in Biden's speech. So let's watch, Tamara, this would be Matthew Miller, clip number three, where there's an exchange with a reporter on this topic.
yeah, thank you. I wanted just to try and understand what the space for, we're talking about going from phase one to phase two in this deal. If you're saying you still have this strong line that Hamas can't run Gaza in the future, but you're also saying that there's no path to total victory, to total sort of eradication of Hamas.
By military means alone, what I mean by that.
Right, so what you're asking is for Hamas to peacefully, the leaders and the members of Hamas to peacefully disarm and sort of just disappear What is the actual sort of proposal here for someone like Yahya Sinwar, who's there? He's a leader. You're saying him and his cadre of leaders of Hamas have no role in the future of Gaza. So where are they going to be in the future?
So because that is quite clearly an issue that will still need to be negotiated. We haven't even gotten the acceptance of this proposal yet, but should it be accepted, phase two, and all these related questions are things that will have to be negotiated as part of the process. I'm not going to do that negotiation here in public. That said, we have long made clear that we think Hamas should lay down its arms, and that continues to be our position.
But you have kind of moved from earlier in the war. I think you were strongly supporting Israel's goal of completely eradicating Hamas. Now there seems to be this little space for they can exist in some form.
That is not at all what our position is. What our position is that you cannot eliminate Hamas just through military means, just through a military campaign. And this has been the experience of the United States in counterterrorism activities all around the world, that a military means by itself, without some kind of political path for the population, will ultimately prove ineffective.
I mean, just two things jump out at me, from that clip. One is that this is the U.S.'s and Israel's position all along, that Hamas needs to surrender completely so that Israel can keep killing Palestinians, which is, a fantasy. It's a very colonial fantasy. And then the second one is that it was almost a tacit admission that the U.S. is still trying to employ some sort of comprador Vichy government like the Palestinian Authority to replace the elected Hamas leadership and government. That's been there. Hillary Clinton in 2006 attempted to form a color revolution essentially and try and hijack and influence the elections. This has been U.S. state policy all along. Is this even like a legitimate proposal? And what does this say about the U.S.'s stance toward Hamas as a political party in the future?
Well, it's clear to me that at the beginning, the Biden administration embraced fully the Israeli goal of destroying Hamas, and they probably believed the Israelis when they said they could do it, and now they recognize that Israel can't, in fact, do it, and they can't say that openly, so what you get is this bizarre, confusing position, which is we're still against Hamas and say that it has no role, but we're also negotiating with it and publicly appealing to Hamas to accept this proposal because we can't proceed with our plan without Hamas's agreement. But it's very strange. Now, since Friday, the U.S. has been trying to rally international support for the proposal. And again, they insist that Hamas, not Israel, is the obstacle. But they're not having a lot of success convincing everyone of that, or probably anyone, as we can see from this exchange between, again, the State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller and the Associated Press correspondent Matt Lee at the State Department briefing. And this was yesterday on Tuesday, June 4th. So let's run that very interesting exchange.
In addition, the Secretary has been emphasizing to partners the importance of the Security Council speaking out to call for implementation of this deal without delay and without further conditions. Yesterday, the United States circulated a new draft Security Council resolution supporting the proposal to end the fighting in Gaza, and we urge all members of the Council to support that resolution. The international community must continue to insist that Hamas accept this deal. The proposal on the table is nearly identical to what Hamas said it would accept just a few weeks ago. Israel has said it is ready to implement it. It is time to finalize this agreement, put an end to the violence, and to build a better future for both Palestinians and Israelis alike. Matt.
So, along those lines, the very intense focus, your very intense focus since Friday has been on, or appears to be, at least from the readouts that you've just been outlining,
on getting Hamas to accept this deal. And you keep saying that the Israelis have already, it was their idea or it's their proposal and they've already agreed to it. And yet, are you really convinced that that's the case? And is are you convinced that the focus should be entirely on Hamas?
So we are convinced it is the case that Israel is ready to implement this deal. As I said, it's their proposal put forward by the government, and they have maintained to us they are ready to implement it. Doesn't mean there aren't voices inside Israel and voices even inside the Israeli government are opposed to it, but the government, speaking on behalf of the government, has said they support this proposal and are ready to stand behind that, and we take them at their word. The deal is in front of Hamas. It is to Hamas to accept or reject or come back and say they want to further negotiate the deal. But it is just the facts of it that Israel has agreed to this proposal and it now stands with Hamas.
It's patently false.
Yeah, well, it's just, again, so the question then is Matthew Miller telling the truth about Israel accepting this deal? And so let's look at the response on Friday to the to Biden's speech, which came from Israel, and we can just show now that's, you know, one article of many that came out, and you can see that Israel describes a permanent ceasefire in Gaza as a non-starter, undermining Gaza's proposal. And that report states that Israel's prime minister on Saturday called a permanent ceasefire in Gaza a non-starter until long-standing conditions for ending the war are met, appearing to undermine a proposal that U.S. President Joe Biden had announced as an Israeli one. And Netanyahu's statement said, quote, Israel's conditions for ending the war have not changed. The destruction of Hamas's military and governing capabilities, the freeing of all hostages, and ensuring that Gaza no longer poses a threat to Israel. Under the proposal, Israel will continue to insist these conditions are met before a permanent ceasefire is put in place. And then, just earlier this morning, we had comments from Yoav Gallant, the Israeli defense minister, so probably the second most senior person in the Israeli government, effectively. And as you can see in the translation there from Israel's Channel 12, Gallant contradicts the proposal for a deal presented by President Biden. Any negotiations with Hamas will only be conducted under fire. So remember, Biden had said that the U.S. would guarantee that the ceasefire would remain in place as long as negotiations continue. Gallant is saying, no, that won't be the case. We will keep bombing, shooting, killing while negotiations take place. So it's very strange that the Israelis seem to reject their own proposal as laid out by President Biden. And then finally, let's just take a look at the response from Hamas, which came in the form of a statement from Osama Hamdan at a press conference in Beirut yesterday. And we can play the video, but because he's speaking in Arabic, I'll just read the translation of what he's saying while that runs in the background. And what Osama Hamdan says is, we received a proposal from the mediators, that's Egypt and Qatar, on the 5th of May, and we announced our agreement to it on the 6th of May. The Israelis did not respond at that time, but instead sent a response to this proposal, and the Qataris informed us of this response. And it is clear that this Israeli response does not conform with a permanent ceasefire or with a total withdrawal of the occupation forces from the Gaza Strip. And this does not agree with the position that the American President Biden took in his speech about a permanent ceasefire and a complete withdrawal, and that we had expressed was positive. The Israeli response speaks about opening the doors to negotiations about everything without end or any time limit. And Biden said that the mediators would guarantee the continuation of the negotiations without end until the two sides reach agreement. This confirms that the Israeli occupation only wants one stage in which it will return its prisoners and then resume its war and aggression against our people. It does not want a ceasefire or to achieve results. Because of all this, we inform the mediators that as long as there is no clear position from the occupation of its readiness for a permanent ceasefire and the complete withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, and this is what can open the door to an agreement, there is no possibility that we will agree any agreement that does not guarantee a permanent ceasefire and a complete withdrawal and the achievement of a real prisoner exchange deal as part of it. So just to kind of decipher that a bit, he's saying our position is the same. What we agreed to on May 6th, a month ago, was a three-phase deal in which there would be a permanent ceasefire. What we're not willing to do is have phase one, where we basically exchange all the prisoners of war or other captives, and then open-ended, no time-limited negotiations, which for Hamas, I suspect, looks a lot like the so-called Oslo peace process that started more than 30 years ago and is still nominally ongoing. And during this endless negotiation, the siege remains in place. Israel will continue bombing, as Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, just said, and so on. Hamas's terms have been very clear. We agree to all this, but the permanent ceasefire is not up for negotiation. The return of Palestinians to their homes is not up for negotiation. And the Israeli withdrawal is not up. They say we can agree on phasing that, that this will be phased, but it has to be agreed. We can't go into phase one, and only then, once Israel has got everything we wanted, we start negotiating on whether or not there'll be a permanent ceasefire and so on. So that's their position. It hasn't changed. And it seems to be that the Biden administration and Hamas are aligned, more aligned than Biden is with Israel. So I guess let's see if Helena can help us sort out this confusion.
Well, thanks so much for that, Ali. I know it's always hard to watch Matt Miller. it's a sacrifice that you make. Let's bring on Helena Cobbin. Helena is a writer and author with decades of experience and knowledge about the region. She's the director of Just World Educational. One of the organization's latest projects is called Understanding Hamas and Why That Matters. The series of public conversations and other educational resources is inspired by the observation that the broad, dishonest, and often virulent campaign of demonization that Israel and Western powers have long maintained against Hamas constitutes a serious obstacle in the path of a permanent ceasefire in Gaza and a just peace. Helena, thank you so much for joining us on the Electronic Intifada live stream. It's so good to have you back.
Well, it's great to be with you and Ali, and you guys are some of my favorite people, and you've done the most amazing work. But hey, you have to inflict Matt Miller on us. You know, I mean, when my son Tariq was about 8 years old, I was briefly the head of the Cub Scout troop, you know, and we would not have accepted Matt Miller into our Cub Scout troop. I mean, for his just sheer mendaciousness, his ability to stand up there and just spout lies.
Ali, do you want to?
What do you think is going on here, Helena? Do you think that the Biden administration, what it sounds like to me is that they're done with this. They want it over because the election is coming up. But what they're not willing to do is to take the decisions that they need to make to end it, which would be the United States saying to Israel, we're done. We're cutting off the weapons pipeline. And you're just going to stop this now. They want, or is it simply an elaborate theater in order to continue the war, but blame Hamas for its continuation? Or is it something else?
I think it's both of those things that you mentioned, but I think we also have to understand how unbelievably inept Biden's diplomacy has been across the board. You know, it's not just on the Gaza crisis, but on the Ukraine crisis and just about every single major thing that's going on. You know, I've studied U.S. foreign policy for, God, 50 years or whatever. And You know, and I know a lot of people who've done high level diplomatic work for the U.S. Many of them were very serious people who understood what they were talking about and had decades of experience. You know, you look at Cy Vance, you look at, I mean, everybody, I have to say, prior to Bill Clinton's presidency, you had very strong secretaries of state and secretaries of defense, national security advisors, and so on. But now Biden has, as his secretary of state and his national security advisor, two people who have been his staffers for decades. You know, they don't have their own expertise. They don't have their own networks of people that they trust. They don't have books that they've published that are, you know, worth reading at all. Do they have any books? I mean, they have been good staff people for Joe Biden through how many senatorial campaigns? That's who they are. So you can't expect them to be able to guide this person. Now, I don't want to get into ageism because I am, as it happens, 71 years old, I think. You know, so I have to be very careful about being ageist, but really the guy is not at the top of his form. I don't know how many people here have read the Time magazine interview, which was conducted, interestingly, a couple of days before the May 31st announcement. But they embargoed it, I guess, and then released it yesterday or the day before. He comes across as extremely incoherent, as he always does when he's talking, you know, not with the teleprompter. And even with the teleprompter, remember that place where he said, you know, something about blah, 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 pause, and he said it. Like, you know, poor guy, you know, send him to a, like a care home someplace, honestly. But meantime, he is in charge of the world's largest nuclear arsenal, and he still thinks, if you read the Time magazine transcript, that the United States does and has the right to unilaterally, hegemonically run the whole world. So it is very sad for the rest of the world.
Well, it's one thing to run the whole world when you're actually capable of running it, for better or worse. I'm not saying that was ever a good thing, but there was a point where the United States was actually powerful enough to dictate to the world. I suppose we'll come to that. Let's park that for a second, because we're going to come back to that discussion. But just sticking with what's going on with this so-called ceasefire proposal, I mean, when you listen to Matt Miller there, providing this sort of alternate reality in which Israel has completely agreed to this, Israel is ready to implement it as soon as Hamas says yes, when that's patently not the case, and it is Hamas that has consistently said, yes, we agree, they've agreed for more than a month to a proposal that was approved by the United States, and then Israel undermined it. I mean, who is this aimed at? I mean, who is this blatantly false messaging aimed at? Who do they think it will persuade? Do they think it will persuade members of the Security Council? Do they think it will persuade South Africa, Brazil, China, and Russia? Do they think it will persuade American voters? Do they think it will persuade Democratic Party donors? Do they think it will persuade members of the Washington press corps? Who is this aimed at?
So a couple of things there, Ali. First of all, this proposal, this kind of set of, you know, the three phases, and each of them being roughly 6 weeks, and you get into, you know, deeper and deeper issues as they proceed. This has been around since the beginning of the year, and Hamas has agreed to it essentially since February. So it's not just 1 month, it's 4 months. You know, that essentially Hamas has been saying, yes, this is how we want it to happen. And, you know, they have, I think, support from Egypt and Qatar on this, and, you know, who are U.S. allies. And now Joe Biden is presenting it as if it's the Israeli proposal, like it's totally.
While bizarre. Israel rejects it.
Right.
And then they blame her. Yeah.
But Ali's question as to who this is directed to, in his speech itself, he seemed to be making a pitch to the Israeli voters. You know, he said there are some in Israel, including in the government, who won't like what I'm about to say, but, you know, here's what I'm saying. And I'm essentially, I think he was trying to present it as though he was appealing to Israeli voters and, you know, the hostage family network there. And maybe to get Benny Gantz to step forward and, you know, topple Netanyahu. But he doesn't know how to do it. Number one, Biden does not know how to do it. And number two, you know, as I wrote recently, two can play at that game. I mean, if Biden thinks that he can, like, assemble a little Israeli coalition to topple Netanyahu, Netanyahu certainly knows how to come to the U.S. Congress. Remember this, he's been invited by Chuck Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, Mike Johnson, and whoever the hell.
And they are, and
they're inviting.
Yeah, Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer are the two Democratic leaders in Congress, and Mike Johnson and, would it be Mitch McConnell?
It's Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, are the two Republican leaders of the House and Senate. And just to remind people, Helena, that just like, was it a month or two ago, Chuck Schumer, the most senior Democrat in the Senate, had called on Netanyahu to go and said how he was leading Israel to disaster and how there needed to be new elections in Israel. And here he is inviting him to address the U.S. Congress.
So we could have a repeat of what we saw in 2015 after after President Obama had completed the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran, to which Netanyahu was opposed, and he came to Congress and spoke out against the JCPOA and against the president from the halls of the U.S. Congress. This could well happen. I don't know when, you know, Congress is planning to have Netanyahu come. Some people say maybe July, but it's bizarre that the two leaders of the Democratic Party in the Congress have concurred with this. And the other very bizarre thing that we need to underline is that at the same time that this week that Biden has this thing on the table, this so-called peace plan, he signed off on the transfer of an additional massive package of U.S. arms to Israel. So it's not even as if he is kind of trying to use the levers of U.S. power to forward his own purported diplomatic proposal.
Indeed. Helena, I want to get your thoughts on, you know, this kind of like U.S. Policy of trying to force Hamas to just surrender. That's you know, according to the U.S. and Israel, that is the plan that they want Hamas to adhere to. What's your thought on that? And also, you know, that could be a good segue into talking about your project, Understanding Hamas and Why It Matters, that you're doing with Just World Educational. If you could talk about that, why you're doing it, and what the intention is with it.
Yeah, I'll come back in on like this idea that you negotiate with Hamas on a deal that would involve Hamas self-immolating, self-destroying. Ain't going to happen. You know, even in 1982, when the U.S. negotiated with Abu Ammar, with Yasser Arafat, to exit Beirut, he was allowed to exit Beirut with all his armed people from Fatah and the rest of the PLO with their arms on a ship, and then they went off into the sunset in Tunis and Yemen and various other places. So that was one thing. You know, you can negotiate that kind of a deal, but you cannot negotiate in good faith with another party that you're actually saying your goal is to destroy them. So the whole thing is political theater of the most grotesque and genocidal kind, honestly. So let's talk about Understanding Hamas, which you know, I've interviewed Hamas leaders in Gaza and elsewhere since the early 1990s, maybe the late 1980s. You know, my memory sometimes gets a little fuzzy, being as how I'm so old. But, you know, people in this country...
I actually have on the shelf behind me
one
of your books, and this is from, I don't know if I should say the date.
But 1984, I think. Or
1984. But this is this is a tremendous reference volume that is sort of one of the seminal works. And that's just to give people who are just joining us or who don't know you a sense of the depth of your knowledge and how far it goes back.
Thank you, Ali. I don't get any royalties from Cambridge University Press anymore for that. It's all in the public domain, but I'm happy for it to be in the public domain. So, I've been interviewing Hamas leaders for a long time. And I understand, obviously, that there were times when Hamas, as a matter of decision, for example, in response to the killings by Baruch Goldstein in 1994 of, I think he killed 29 worshippers in the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron. And at that point, Hamas said, you know, if he can do this, then we will visit something similar on Israeli civilians. And they unleashed a deliberate campaign against Israeli civilians. And then they took the decision to stop that in, I think, 97 or so. So, you know, these are political decisions that they make. It's a political organization. It has very deep roots in Palestinian society. But a lot of people in the Palestine rights movement here in the West don't even want to talk about Hamas, which is, to me, incredibly patronizing. It's a very, you know, like, I would rather talk about humanitarian things. And if you insist on talking about Hamas, that's going to distract attention from the humanitarian needs. You know, honestly, I mean, I totally understand the need to talk about the humanitarian crisis. And so many people are doing wonderful work. But I do go back to some work I did on Rwanda in the 1990s when there was the genocide there. And there were people in Uganda who were taking the bodies of the genocided people out of the river as they came down the river and burying them on the banks of the river. I forget which river it was. In Uganda, and people, Western correspondents went and said to them, like, how do you manage to do this? What can we do to help you, you know, bury all these bodies? And the people who were burying the bodies said, we don't need your help burying the bodies. We need your help stopping the bodies coming down the river. And that's the way that I look at the need for smart, informed political intervention in this dreadful genocidal conflict. So long as people don't want to talk about Hamas, they only want to talk about humanitarian stuff, the bodies will continue. You know? So, yes, Hamas has done some bad things. Guess what? Israel has done some bad things. Guess what? The U.S. has done a few bad things. Guess what? Fatah and the PLO did some pretty terrible things back in the day. Now, I was a little bit involved. Thank you, Ali, for the shout out for the book. But, you know, then I worked with my spouse, Bill Quant, a little bit on helping to open up a diplomatic channel between Fatah and George Shultz at the end of the George H.W. Bush administration. And it was really important work. It didn't immediately lead to anything. And then when it led to something, it led to Oslo. But that's, you know, that wasn't our fault. But, you know, it was a matter back then in the 1980s of trying to demonize the PLO, which was widely and in some instances correctly described as a terrorist organization. It was a political organization that on occasion, as after the Black September, had made a deliberate decision to use some forms of anti-civilian violence.
As had, by the way, Nelson Mandela, which he describes in his book, The Long Walk to Freedom, which is also on the shelf behind me, where he describes very in great detail the strategy of the ANC, the African National Congress, which included the resort to what he called terrorism, using his word. But the point, of course, is that this type of violence, what Nelson Mandela says, is the form of the struggle of the oppressed is determined by the oppressor. In other words, neither the PLO, nor Hamas, nor the African National Congress wanted to use that kind of violence. But right, there you go, another key text. But the point is that the violence of the oppressor, which is always far greater, is never described as terrorism. It's only the response of the oppressed which is described as terrorism.
Project, and you know, Nora is actually on our board at Just World Ed, and she's been a really super supporter for this project. She even came on to our last webinar and really enriched it there. We had five webinars, in which we, Rami Khoury, who is a Palestinian Christian, in case you didn't know, Palestinian Christian from Nazareth, and I had these five webinar conversations with five specialists. So the specialists were people who had written books about Hamas, Azam Tamimi, Paola Caridi, wonderful Italian writer, Khaled Haroub, and Moin Rabbani, and somebody else. Oh, a really amazing Dutch specialist whose work I was not familiar with till I pulled this together, called Jeroen Gunning. So Jeroen is actually a really smart guy, teaches at King's College London. He is one of the founders of a whole field of academic study called critical terrorism studies. So, you know, I'll be quite honest. I had never even heard of critical terrorism studies until, you know, I started getting like into contact with Jeroen. But it's a serious field that they founded about 15, 20 years ago, essentially doing for the field of terrorism studies what people broadly here in the United States do in the field of critical race studies. You know, taking apart all the myths that have been created and sustained in the past in order to essentially serve the colonial agenda in the case of terrorism studies. So it was really useful to have Jeroen. He was on our third webinar, and he had spent a lot of time in the 1990s doing his research in Gaza, interviewing a very broad range of Hamas people and other people in Gaza in its early years. Paola Caridi, who was the other non-Palestinian expert that we had, worked as a journalist and researcher in Jerusalem in the early, I think, 2003 through 2012. And she, again, in that capacity, she did a lot of interviewing of Hamas people, especially during that crucial time when Hamas ran for elections in the PLC elections. That was like accepting Oslo in a way. And then when they won the elections, they, you know, felt the absolute wrath of the Israeli U.S. imperial oppression machine. So these were five amazing conversations. The last one was with Azam Tamimi, who is London-based Palestinian veteran researcher, who is, we describe him as close to Hamas, with reason, I think, because this is the title of his book. It's Hamas, A History from Within. this is what, how it's titled in this country. In England, it has a different title. But, you know, it was really good for us to have these conversations and cover some of the very basic stuff about, you know, Hamas's origins within the kind of social service networks of the Muslim Brotherhood, essentially, and then how they decided to enter politics as such, and their attitudes to women, and the many, many ways in which Hamas is very clearly not identical to ISIS, which is what, obviously, the Israeli talking points on October 7th and since have been, you know, Hamas equals ISIS. And people on the left in this country seem to have bought a huge amount of that Kool-Aid, you know, and not to want to talk about Hamas because it's like disquieting for them.
And that's, if I may say, Helena, I think that's a key point, which is that even a lot of people who ostensibly support Palestine or the Palestinian struggle, people who would consider themselves on the left, will preface their comments with condemnation of Hamas. Of course, Hamas is terrible, but of course, what Hamas did is, you know, incomprehensibly horrible, but these sorts of statements. And I think the importance of what you're doing is enormous, because these tactics of demonizing this is what colonial rulers always do. They demonize the African National Congress. They demonize the anti-colonial struggle in India. They demonized it in Kenya. Oh, it was the same story all over the world. We'll never talk to these people. We'll never, you know, the Americans, of course, demonized the Taliban, accused them of the worst crimes possible. And then, of course, they negotiated with them and withdrew from Afghanistan. And the Taliban are back in power. And you may love them or hate them, but it's none of our business, because, you know, that we can't decide what happens in Afghanistan. If there's any lesson that the so-called West should take, it's that. But these tactics of demonization, rather than receding, and this was a key, I mean, this is something I've also studied and read a lot and written about, you know, the peace process in Ireland required the de-demonization of Sinn Féin and the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. Now Sinn Féin is the leading party in Ireland, very likely to win elections. It's now the governing party in the north, the British-occupied north of Ireland. And, you know, there's still a lot of dissatisfaction. People say, well, Ireland is still partitioned. Part of it's still under British rule. That's true. But they successfully ended the violence, which is not a small thing. And there is a political process. But that could only come about with the de-demonization of Sinn Féin and the IRA and the recognition that these were stakeholders without whom you could not have any prospect of a political settlement. But it seems to me that in the West, these tactics are actually expanding now to demonize everyone. So Russia is demonized. China is demonized. Anyone who disagrees with the United States is demonized. And to even speak to them is to reward them. So you can't negotiate with your opponents or enemies until they've surrendered to you first. Well, if they've already surrendered to you, what is there to negotiate about? And if they won't surrender and you can't defeat them and you're unwilling to talk to them, then you're completely stuck. So
Ali, you're not stuck. If you can't talk to them, then you have to carry on genociding them. I mean, that's what the Israelis really want to do. And, you know,
that's true.
So, you know, that's their agenda here. I would say maybe two-thirds of the Israeli body politic thinks that, and this is in some of the opinion polls, thinks that what the military is doing in Gaza is either just right or not enough.
Right. But, I mean, that's more or less what we'd expect from Israel. But, you know, you would expect something different from the United States or perhaps the Europeans or others. I don't want to blow my own trumpet, but I'm going to a little bit. I'm going to drop, Tamara, I'm going to drop in the chat a link to this article, which I wrote in June of 2021. And this was just after the previous Israeli war on Gaza. And the article is headlined, I don't know if we can bring it up. I'm sorry to surprise you with this, Tamara. But it's titled, "It's Time to Change Liberal Discourse About Hamas." And I take on some of these questions. One of the points I try to make is that you have to actually listen to what Hamas is saying. You have to listen to what its leaders are. You have to read what its founding documents and subsequent policy documents say in order to understand it. And that would seem to be a very basic point that is lost on most people, even many people on the left, who are happy to adopt the sort of demonizing talking points about Hamas rather than to actually pay attention. And so with your project, you're going much further, of course, than I went in this article. And I think that's very, really very commendable. And people can find those conversations on the Just World Educational YouTube channel, where they're all there, the five webinars with Khaled Ahroub, who also wrote an excellent book about Hamas. I forget the title of it, but it's also an excellent book, with Paula Karidi, Mu'in Rabbani, and Azam Tamimi. And these are all really excellent discussions that people should highly recommend people listen to.
If I could just get back to what you're saying about the left there, Ali. By the way, thanks for the shout out. I mean, you know, actually these videos on YouTube have been getting better viewership numbers than anything we've done since we had Vijay Prashad on at the beginning of the Ukraine war. And so I'm just delighted that we seem to be meeting a real need. I think they, you know, they've gone pretty viral. And yeah, Nora is also signaling something that was in Mondo Weiss by Abdeljawad
Omar. Yeah,
Omar. Yeah, that very, very important. But I think what has been happening over, let's say, I don't know, maybe it's always been the case in this country. You know, I grew up in England in the 1950s and 1960s, the era of decolonization, when it was just like meat and potatoes, everything, every day practically on the BBC, you'd have like the leader of some African or Asian country that last week was in jail and accused of the worst things and terrorism and all kind of terrible things. And here he is this week on the BBC, and the local governor general is hauling down the Union Jack, and they're hauling up the, you know, the flag of the independent country. And who is the new president? It's the guy who last week was in jail. You know, that was like seeing decolonization in action, and the National Health Service were the two things that like defined my childhood, honestly. And both of them were only made possible because of decisions that the government made to move away from militarism and toward, you know, better policies. And sadly, that has been reversed by more recent governments. In this country, you never had that, like, very vivid experience of decolonization as a thing. I mean, in as much as Americans have a history of relationship with colonization, it was like wiping out the Native American peoples right across the country here, and then, you know, saving Europe, which also involved saving European empires in two world wars in the 20th century, and then getting bogged down in Vietnam, which was, you know, obviously a very salutary experience for many Americans who had never realized like how brutal colonialism is, and that it harms everybody. And if you think back to the demonization of the Viet Cong in the day, you know, I remember reading in Reader's Digest, my Auntie Hetty used to have like back copies of the Reader's Digest. And I, you know, they were publishing all kinds of stuff about the Viet Cong, you know, like how they cut the breasts off women and they rape people and they do this and that, which of course was exactly what the Americans were doing. So it, as with the case of Israeli demonization of Hamas, it's a projection of their own kind of worst desires that they project onto the oppressed. So I think Americans and Westerners in general have become very used, especially since the end of the Cold War, to looking at the world in terms of kind of rosy-colored spectacles of human rights and humanitarianism. And let's keep the emphasis on human rights, you know. So if Hamas is accused of violating human rights, oh, if Iran is accused of violating human rights, oh, if China, then we have to jump on that bandwagon and all the movements have to do with that, rather than the underlying realities of an existing colonial order, especially in Palestine. So, you know, I think those are some of the things that have been going on, and that's why we're doing the project now. It does matter that people should understand Hamas.
Well, Helena, we have a few minutes left, but we wanted to get your analysis on the global, you know, geopolitical shifts that are happening, the rise of China and Russia and relative decline of the United States. Can you talk about the picture you're seeing and what you read into it? And do you think that Russia and China, for example, are doing enough to try and end the U.S.-backed genocide in Gaza and hold Israel to account?
Oh, gosh. Just a few minutes?
We never have enough time with you. We never do.
So, well, that's sweet of you. So I did write a piece in Boston Review that came out in February about the fact that the Operation Deluge, whatever it's called, Al-Aqsa Deluge, whatever.
Flood, yeah.
Al-Aqsa Flood. The October 7th break.
Yeah.
Yeah. The October 7th prison breakout from Gaza occurred within a specific global dynamic of obviously crumbling U.S. power and growing Chinese ability to exercise constructive diplomacy in many regions of the world, including West Asia, which is what I call the Middle East, not to be Eurocentric about this anymore. So one of the key things there was the reconciliation they brought about between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which changed a lot of things in the region. And then you had the Russians withstanding the U.S. military complex in Ukraine and the whole U.S.-led military campaign in Ukraine, and you had BRICS expanding. So there's a lot of little pieces that happened during 2023 prior to October 7th that signaled that the global balance is changing, but it has not changed enough yet. Now, that change, which I think is characterized most clearly by the erosion of U.S. power, has certainly been accelerated by the resilience that Hamas has shown at all levels, militarily, politically, and in terms of just sticking by their guns. I don't mean guns. I mean sticking by their position in Gaza. It's
and their guns, frankly. And their guns.
Yeah, and their guns.
Yeah.
So I don't know if any of you saw the... this is pathetic, Helena, doing audio visuals, okay? I don't know if any of you saw the... maybe Tamara can find it and pop this into the chat. I should have sent this. I'm sorry. The Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, which is Khalil Shikaki's body that he runs out of Ramallah, And it's generally, I have to say, fairly anti-Hamas in its orientation, in as much as, you know, if you look at the way he asks questions, and he's very focused on electoral, you know, if it was Marwan Barghouti against Yahya Sinwar, who would you vote for? If it was Mustafa Barghouti against Ismail Haniyeh, who would you vote for? But this one that he released most recently in April on the pcpsr.org website has some amazing opinion research. And what he's saying
is... Can actually
is,
get that up here, Helena, and...
Okay, click on it, yeah, Tamara. It's a PDF, so you get the PDF. And... Go down to page 16. Sorry about this.
No, it's. I think
page
it was
16.
Also. It was also
yeah,
here. I think
there.
I also sent you the. Yeah.
Yeah. Super. Okay. So what? Okay. I really have to look at this. Look at those two over on the right there. This is. Now I shall ask you about several Palestinian actors and whether you are satisfied or dissatisfied, I assume that the numbers they give here are satisfied, with their performance in the current war. So these questions were asked of the same panel of respondents in the West Bank and in Gaza, remembering that there are more people in the West Bank than there are in Gaza, in December 2023 and in March of 2024. So if you look at the Gaza figures over on the right there, can you actually make this bigger, Tamara? Yes, yes, and go over to the right. So between December and March, so the blue is Hamas as an actor. Are you satisfied with the performance of Hamas? Orange is Yahya Sinwar as a personality. Gray is Fatah as an organization. And yellow is President Abbas. So look at the trend between December and March. In Gaza, Hamas actually gained more support in Gaza in spite of all the truly terrible things that the Israeli military was doing in Gaza to the people there between December and March. And then, you know, the numbers for Fatah and Abbas are very low. If Tamara could come out a little bit, but it's fine if she can't.
Notable, I don't know how you could take a valid opinion poll in Gaza under these circumstances. I used to do various social studies and surveys, and the idea of getting a valid sample and... But nonetheless, and as you point out, this Khalil Shkachi outfit does tend to be anti-Hamas historically, or at least not very favorable towards them. So it's telling that even they are coming up with this. So I do think that that is an interesting observation.
But I guess where I was going with this, and sorry, I just find these numbers fascinating. And he does give a fairly good description of how he did, you know, how his people did the methodology in Gaza. I also think the figures for the West Bank are interesting, although, you know, the support for Hamas and Sinwar went down between December and March. Still, they are ways, ways higher than support for Fatah and Abbas. In the West Bank, you know, where the U.S. funded patronage networks, you know, should be like just revving up the support for Fatah and Abu Mazen. But sadly, it doesn't seem our tax dollars seem not to have been terribly effective in that regard. But that was just to underline the fact that there is resilience at all levels in Gaza by Hamas and its networks of supporters who, you know, are extremely active at many levels of policing, of, you know, social service provision, trying to organize the people in the displacement centers and so on and so forth. That resilience has really forced the ICC and the ICJ and the international community writ large to confront the horrors of what Israel is doing. You know, back in the colonial era, if the British were like bombing the heck out of FLOSI, what was it, the freedom something of South Yemen, the people in South Yemen, the independent independence movement in South Yemen, the British Air Force was bombing the shit out of them. And nobody really knew, nobody could really care. Maybe, you know, somebody would write a little report in some Soviet newspaper or whatever. But now you've got a mobilized international community that is responding to this resilience by Hamas. And to me, one of the really interesting things that's happening right now, especially with the ICC, the ICC is essentially a European project. It's like, because most European countries are members of the ICC. By the way, the United States is not a member of the ICC. And it was kind of I did a lot of work on the ICC 20 years ago. It was basically a way for them to kind of hold, to bring criminal cases against bad black leaders in Africa. So it was kind of a quintessential human rights / humanitarian type of thing. And they managed to get many, many countries in the global south to sign on to the ICC treaty using their aid dollars, you know, to essentially buy support from countries in the global south. But it does have like it's supposed to apply to everybody, not just bad black leaders, but also bad white leaders. So finally, Karim Khan, you know, the chief prosecutor, was forced to ask for arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant, and also, of course, against Hamas and Yahya Sinwar and Ismail Haniyeh. But this sent the U.S. political system into paroxysms. You know, Matthew Miller, our friend Matthew Miller in the State Department, you know, he hates, I mean, the State Department says that you can't trust the ICC, you know, and they're not going to allow the ICC to send anybody here to this country. And it's just like the campaigns against the ICC that we had before.
Although, Helena, Lloyd Austin, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, when he was asked if the Pentagon would continue to assist the ICC to gather evidence against Russia in Ukraine, he said yes.
Oh, of course, yes.
So the United States recognizes the ICC when it comes to its own interests of trying to isolate Russia, but doesn't when it comes to its friend and ally and client Israel. So, but I mean, to sort of bring it back to Nora's question about the geopolitical shifts, I mean, clearly the U.S. is losing power. They can't just give orders as they could 20, 30 years ago in the immediate Cold War, post-Cold War period, or at the time of the first U.S.-Iraq War in 1991, or the U.S. invasion in 2003, when the whole world was sort of terrified of the United States post 9/11. I think it's fair to say the U.S. Now inspires more contempt than fear around the world. And certainly not a lot of love as it used to, except in small pockets like Far West Asia, which is the term we should now use for Europe, and you know, a few other little. I even saw a poll the other day that even Japan, which the public was very pro-American, the public now is shifting. So these shifts are happening, but at the same time, and you, as you mentioned, China in particular is playing a much bigger role. We see it playing a huge role in terms of bringing Saudi Arabia and Iran together. They recently, just a few days ago, hosted Arab leaders for a Sino-Arab summit. So China is clearly taking on a bigger role, but you know there are criticisms saying, well, but when it comes to stopping this genocide, which China has been very critical of, and it's been one of the few countries that has openly defended the Palestinian right to resist through armed struggle. You don't hear that very often from countries. When can we see these shifts starting to have a decisive role, not simply, let's say, weakening the U.S. as an actor, but actually strengthening, or maybe we don't want that. Maybe we don't want a world in which one country can give the orders. Are we shifting towards a functional international system in which the UN Security Council would actually play a role, possibly and hopefully a reformed Security Council? Or are we in a period of an in-between period that's going to last a long time? Maybe you don't. I mean, you can dust off your crystal ball, but maybe you don't. You have it with you.
Oh, I have it. I got it in my pocket right here.
Yeah.
So I would say, when can we see the international community taking an active role in ending this genocide? I would say when they have figured out how to overcome or work around the U.S. veto. Because as you mentioned, obviously, the Security Council is extremely anti-democratic and dysfunctional by virtue of the veto. So I just go back to, again, my childhood in the 1950s when Anthony Eden and Guy Mollet of France and Ben Gurion of Israel undertook this tripartite aggression against Egypt with the goal of toppling President Gamal Abdel Nasser. So two of those three parties had vetoes in the Security Council at the time. Because of the international situation, Eisenhower was opposed to this tripartite aggression. He was desperately embarrassed by it at a time when he wanted to gin up anti-Russian, anti-Soviet feelings and actions in the world. So how did he deal with the veto that the British and French had in the Security Council? He basically pulled the economic plug on both countries, but especially Britain. He said, you know, we've been supporting the pound sterling for a long time. That's not necessarily going to carry on happening. And within, I want to say, 24 hours or maybe, you know, 36 hours after he delivered that, Anthony Eden retracted and agreed to withdraw from Egypt. They did actually, as part of that, occupy Gaza and committed many horrible atrocities inside Gaza. So there is a way of getting around a veto that is short of nuclear war, you know, because another way would be to bomb the other country, but that's not going to happen and we wouldn't want it to happen. And that is to actually bring economic power to bear. So I am thinking, based on a lot of reading that I've done, a lot of people I've talked about these things with, that the Chinese and the Russians and their allies in BRICS, maybe not so much the Indians, but who knows? But you remember, BRICS has recently expanded. It now includes South Africa and Egypt, and Turkey is wanting to join. It's Saudi Arabia has joined, Iran has joined. It's a very interesting new multipolar economics-based organization that is not a military bloc. So, you know, I think many of us are hoping that it will really usher in a new era of multipolarity using a sense of international fairness and a sense of joint economic interest to build a new coalition in the world that is not built on military power. So when might they pull the plug on the U.S. dollar? That's my question, in the way that Eisenhower pulled the plug on the pound sterling. You know, the way that Joe Biden is going in his slavish imitation of Donald Trump in terms of anti-Chinese policies at every level, economic and military, I think, you know, it's so foolish. And this is, again, coming back to the fact that he doesn't have any adults in his advisory, like, councils in the National Security Council. So he's really bringing forward the day when the BRICS and their allies are going to say, look, sorry, we cannot no longer continue supporting the U.S. dollar. And that, you can see some of that is already happening, de-dollarization. It's painfully slow as of now. It's not, you know, your 24-hour Dwight Eisenhower picks up the phone, speaks to Anthony Eden, and then everything happens, you know, very speedily. But we are building that world. We are building a new multipolar world. And it just, you know, breaks my heart that it's being done through so much misery in Gaza and the destruction of 10 universities in Gaza and all the plans that my publishing company had for doing, you know, joint projects with people from Gaza. Those projects, our plans will continue, but in the meantime, we have to get through this misery. So,
yeah.
And of course, just before we let you go, Helena, we'll remind people that you publish through Just World Books this wonderful, important volume, Gaza Writes Back.
I also published this, I have to say, by
10 years ago.
Yeah, 10 years ago. Can you imagine, like, what effect those SJP people have had over the past 10 years? But yeah, I'm very proud of what we've published.
Yeah.
You work closely with our dear friend Rifat al-Ar'ir. And it is now...
And you know, Ali, we're going to be bringing out a new memorial edition of his book with a wonderful foreword. I'm literally going to put Ali on the spot here because Ali has promised to write the foreword for the new edition.
And it's
so
my
thank
honor
you,
to
Ali.
Do so. And it is now 6 months, tomorrow, 6 months...
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Rifat was murdered, and we remember him every day and continue to see the light that he shines throughout the world through the enormous impact he's had on so many people. And we're grateful to you for the work you did with him and continue to do by disseminating his work as well.
Indeed. Well, Helena Cobbin, you are the director of Just World Educational, and we can direct people to go to justworldeducational.org. And sign up for the newsletter. You'll get informed about the next, hopefully there will be more in the Understanding Hamas series, but you can get all the information.
Oh, we're planning a mixtape.
That's great. I love it. I'm inspired by the resistance itself. Helena Cobbin, thank you so much for all the work that you do. And we'd love to have you back on very soon, of course.
Thank you guys for all you do. I'm just going to sit here and listen to John Elmer.
Wonderful.
We're all going to learn from John. Thank you so much, Helena.
Thank you. And you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Ali Abunima. Let's bring John on. Hello.
Hi, guys. That was fun.
Yeah.
Great to see you, Helena.
Yeah, there's a lot that we didn't even have time to get into. But
you know, we come up with a list of topics we want to talk about with Helena, and we inevitably only get through half of them because she's so knowledgeable and so informative that we will, you know, get her back again. But just again to stress, you know, the Just World Educational YouTube channel has those in-depth discussions about Hamas and much more, so worthwhile. So really, if you want more, that's the place to go and get it.
Yep, exactly. All right. Well, John, you're going to take us through the Battle of Jabalia over the last week and also what's happening in the north with Hezbollah and also Yemen. Let's get into it.
Yeah, I just wanted to also say off the top, because we were talking about the ceasefire, that the resistance ceasefire demands have been clear for many, many months. And I'll just reiterate them here, because that was a very complicated American-Israeli theatrics that's happening. The number one, there's four points. Stop the aggression, which is just obvious. Withdraw your forces from Gaza, also obvious. Allow people to return to their homes. And reconstruction, no siege, end the siege. And those are four basic humanitarian requirements. And I don't think that anyone in the world would expect anything different from a people who are experiencing a genocide right now. And these are the basic requirements. The prisoner exchange is secondary to those principal requirements. And the resistance has made that clear all along, and they haven't changed their position at all. We're just waiting for Israel to move closer and closer to that position, as always is the case in these negotiations. That's how the Gilad Shalit negotiations worked, and it's going to be how these work, and we've said that from the beginning. So I just wanted to put that out there, and all the resistance factions all agree on that. That's the Joint Operations Room functioning. They agree on those principles. They don't have divergent views on point two, point four. They don't negotiate around the nuance. These are clear humanitarian requirements for a people experiencing a genocide. So I just wanted to throw that out there to link that to the beginning, the discussion about the ceasefire. So today we are going to do the same thing we have been doing. We still have videos covering only the days since you last saw me, and we're going to start in the south. With Rafa, we've got a couple maps here that we'll throw up to show, just so people can understand what we're going to do. Rafa there in the bottom of the map on the border with Egypt along the Mediterranean Sea. You see up where it says Gaza, that's actually the middle camps area that's now under attack. A little further north, you see Netzarim Corridor. We will report a little bit more on that today just because we've been following that story. And then the map of Rafa, if we could throw that one up tomorrow. Did we lose tomorrow? Oh, there we go. Yeah, so this is the focused map of Rafa, and you can see the purple is Israeli operations. I had never put these maps up because these are just lies. It makes it look like Israel controls all of that territory, but they don't. That's the area that they're destroying, but they're not in control of that territory in the way the map suggests. If you look at the bottom of that map, that's Kerem Shalom. That's the main Israeli crossing where the food supplies and aid has been coming into the south when it was a safe zone. In order to make it not a safe zone that could be attacked, the Israelis have essentially closed that crossing. They've also closed the crossing that's just up a bit from there, that's the Gazans crossing with Egypt for supplies. And then where you see the two arrows there, that's the Rafah crossing, Al Auda crossing. That's the pedestrian, the passenger crossing that has been closed to people desperately needing medical attention that has been dismantled in Gaza purposely by Israel. And now they're blocking the exit for the people that need to leave. But the main thing to point out about this is the purple line going right up to the Mediterranean Sea there from the border with Israel. That's the Philadelphia corridor. I told you a little bit about that last week or the last couple weeks. Israel took the complete corridor since we last reported for you guys. So that's what that looks like. And at the top, you can see there. Is the Mediterranean coast, and the dot that's just above the purple line, that's Tel Sultan. That's where the tent massacres were. And you can see why it created mass panic in the camps, in the safe zones, which are up along the coast. They're up a little higher towards Khan Yunis, Mawasi, where people are taking shelter, because the Israelis were moving in from the east side, pushing westward. And it looked like they were going to go neighborhood by neighborhood. But what they actually did was just focused on the Philadelphia corridor. And they raced up that corridor last week and carried out, I think Nora reported on really great in her introduction, at least three tent massacres, one in particularly brutal one. that created a mass flight of people from the Mawasi area, from the Tel Sultan area, where people believed that they would be safe for at least a number of weeks, because there's population centers on the western edge of Rafah, which is not true in the other areas that Israel has fought. And so the amount people were expecting it to take time for the Israelis to move through the Rafah camp, Yibna camp, all the way up to Tel Sultan. But because where you can see that they've run that corridor, they created mass panic in the camp. They massacred people in their tents. And now those people have fled from Rafah. More than a million people have fled Rafah and moved up to the middle camps, as Nora reported. And now the middle camps are under attack by the Israelis. So just a brutal situation. We'll start with Rafah and move to the north. I just wanted to give people a real sense of what we're talking about. And moving up the Philadelphia corridor isn't some kind of military accomplishment. It's a demilitarized zone that the Israelis negotiated with the Egyptians to be a demilitarized zone. Also in the Second Intifada, Israel destroyed all the houses that would be along the Philadelphia corridor. That's where Rachel Corrie was killed trying to defend homes of families in the Rafah camp who had their homes demolished to create the Philadelphia corridor. So this is not a heroic military operation. It's racing up a demilitarized zone and attacking people living in tents. And as was pointed out, people who were born in tents in the late 1940s and 1950s are dying in tents today. And not just the elderly. We know that children that have been born since this war began are also being killed in tents that they were born in and are living in. So that's what the genocide looks like in the granular way. And Nora's been doing such a great job off the introduction of giving us that news context for all of this reporting, which I always just want to bring in that humanitarian element in before we talk about the resistance, because the population is part of the resistance, and the courage with which they have carried out and the dignity with which they have carried out experiencing this genocide, the way they clean their houses, that it was a very moving part of Nora's presentation that I always appreciate. It was actually like the first thing that I noticed when I moved to Palestine. I moved to Jenin in the Intifada. And as soon, it wasn't just on a large scale, like after the end of the invasion, it would be as soon as the tanks left, because the tanks would drive down the street, knock the trees over, destroy the roundabouts, crush the curbs, smash people's doors of their shops in. And as soon as the tanks would leave, people would come out and immediately fix the curbs and sweep the streets. And that's something that has been going on in Palestinian society for a long time. And when you see it with your own eyes, like Nora showed that footage of the woman cleaning out her apartment and living in these apartments with no walls, I just think that the dignity and courage of that is resistance par excellence. And so I want to always keep that in focus when we're talking about the armed struggle, which we will do today, starting with number one tomorrow. And these are videos that I wish that these ones, they would give us 15 seconds before and after. This is a Yassin strike in Rafah. And you could just see, you could see the destruction, the hellscape, landscape. But you could see the fighters using that. They're using the destruction to their advantage. If you look back there, we'll just let this run a couple times. Because if you could just imagine what it looked 15 seconds before this, and then 15 seconds after, as this fighter moves through those alleys in order to get into a position to strike within 50 meters, which is where the effective range of the Yassin RPG, and within the range that often does.
Welcome back. And that was Electronic Intifada. And that's going to conclude our program for today. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's the Pan-African Radio Network. And if you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And we're going to close out with the music of the legendary Grant Green, the guitarist extraordinaire. And of course, this is in line with our month-long contribution and acknowledgement of the Black Music Month. And of course, we will continue on this path over the next few weeks that we have of this month and beyond. Yes. And this is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Thank you.